AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome, Deep Divers. Picture a man so famously reserved, so quiet, that, well, the entire nation knew him as Silent Cal.
Right.
Now imagine that same man running the show, the United States, during its most vibrant and tumultuous decade, the Roaring Twenties.
Quite a contrast.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if that's not intriguing enough, get this. He was the only U.S. president ever born on Independence Day.
A nice bit of trivia.
It is. And then his presidential oath, administered by his own father, by the flickering light of a kerosene lamp, middle of the night, in a remote Vermont farmhouse.
It's a compelling image, isn't it? A figure really steeped in paradox, right from the very start of his public life.
And that paradox is really key to understanding him, isn't it? This quiet man navigating such a boisterous era.
Definitely.
Today we're diving deep into the life and presidency of John Calvin Coolidge Jr., the 30th president of the United States. He served from 1923 to 1929, a truly pivotal time, you know, when America was really coming into its own. Now, while he's widely remembered for that taciturn personality and his unwavering commitment to small government conservatism.
Which is true, of course.
Right. But we're going to show you that he's a figure far more complex and influential than he's often given credit for. His policies, his principles, I mean, whether you agree with them or not, they still spark debate and echo powerfully in our political discussions today.
They really do. And our mission in this deep dive is, well, it's to shortcut your way to being truly well-informed about Coolidge. We've meticulously sifted through a rich collection of articles, biographies, historical analyses.
A lot of material.
A lot. And we've pulled out the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight. You'll get those surprising facts, maybe just enough humor to keep you engaged, ensuring you walk away with a comprehensive understanding of his journey, his policies, some quite groundbreaking and the lasting arguments around his legacy. And crucially, you'll get all of this without feeling, you know, overwhelmed by just tons of historical data.
Exactly. Think of us as your expert guides to this fascinating stuff. We've compiled biographical details, in-depth policy analyses, the broader historical context, and some genuinely captivating anecdotes to help us navigate Coolidge's world. We'll trace his path from a pretty humble Vermont upbringing, all the way to the highest office in the land. So to truly appreciate Coolidge's journey, we really need to start at the beginning. Let's dig into his earliest influences, his roots. Okay, so to really get a handle on the man who would become president, we need to ground ourselves in his origins. Let's dive into Coolidge's roots. He was born John Calvin Coolidge Jr. on July 4th, 1872.
Independence Day.
Independence Day. In Plymouth Notch, Vermont. That makes him the only U.S. president with a birthday on the 4th of July, which is, you know, pretty cool distinction.
It is.
And from very early childhood, apparently he was always addressed by his middle name, Calvin. It was a family tradition, honoring John Calvin, the Protestant reformer.
Yeah, and that detail kind of hints at the deep-seated values within his family, doesn't it? And a key insight here is how far back his American lineage goes and what that really signified. I mean, his family tree isn't just a list of names. It's like a living tapestry of early American history.
Right.
We're talking ancestors dating back to the 1630s, people like John Coolidge from England settling in Massachusetts.
Wow, 1630s.
Yeah, leaders in colonial conflicts like King Philip's War. Samuel Appleton was an ancestor. Revolutionary War officers like another John Coolidge, his great-great-grandfather. And generations of state legislators, including his own grandfather, Calvin Galusha Coolidge.
So this wasn't just a family. It was a lineage steeped in civic duty public service.
Exactly. It almost feels like it was predestining Coolidge for his own political path in a way.
It sounds like his family wasn't just his lineage, but really the crucible of his character. How specifically did his father's industriousness and those, you know, early losses imprint on his famously reserved personality?
Well, his immediate family definitely shaped him profoundly. His father, John Calvin Coolidge Sr., was a truly industrious man, a prosperous farmer, storekeeper, a dedicated public servant.
Held lots of local offices.
Oh, yeah. Justice of the Peace, tax collector, served in both houses of the Vermont General Assembly, a pillar of the community.
But young Calvin experienced significant loss early on, didn't he?
He did. His mother, Victoria Josephine Moore, died when she was just 39. Calvin was only 12. Possibly from tuberculosis.
Oh, well, that's young.
Very. And then, when he was 18, his younger sister, Abigail Grace Coolidge, died at 15, likely from appendicitis.
Wow. Two major losses as a teenager.
Yeah. His father did later remarry and live to be 80, but those early losses, they stick with you.
That's a powerful observation. So these early losses, coupled with his father's, you know, unwavering industriousness and strong work ethic, that must have played a huge role in shaping the young Coolidge.
Undeniably. It likely contributed to his famously reserved nature, that quiet determination that would define his public and private life. This sort of stoicism, maybe born of early hardship, it really became a hallmark of his public image later on.
So with these foundational experiences, marked by both discipline and, well, profound loss, a young Coolidge starts to forge his intellectual identity. This sets the stage for the principles that would guide his entire career.
Right. He attended Black River Academy and St. Johnsbury Academy before enrolling at Amherst College.
And he did well there.
He did. He really distinguished himself, particularly in debating, apparently.
Yeah.
And he graduated cum laude. But it wasn't just about the grades or the debating trophies. It was about the ideas he encountered there.
Okay, like what?
Well, while at Amherst, he was deeply influenced by his philosophy professor, Charles Edward Garvin. Garman was a congregational mystic, apparently, with a neo-Hegelian philosophy.
Neo-Hegelian. What does that mean in practice?
It's a school of thought, emphasizing, sort of, a progressive ethical development towards a higher societal purpose, a belief in reason unfolding in history. And it deeply shaped Coolidge's worldview.
Interesting.
And it's quite revealing how these early philosophical teachings informed the man who would later champion, you know, pro-business, small government policies.
Mm-hmm.
40 years later, Coolidge actually articulated Garman's ethics. He said, and I'm quoting here.
Okay.
There is a standard of righteousness that might does not make right, that the end does not justify the means, and that expediency as a working principle is bound to fail. The only hope of perfecting human relationships is in accordance with the law of service, under which men are not so solicitous about what they shall get as they are about what they shall give.
That's quite profound. Service over getting.
Exactly. But he continues, yet people are entitled to the rewards of their industry. What they earn is theirs, no matter how small or how great. But the possession of property carries the obligation to use it in a larger service.
Ah, okay. That insight really reframes things, doesn't it? Connecting his early philosophy directly to his later policies. So it wasn't just about making money.
No.
But the ethical framework around it, the responsibility that comes with property and wealth.
Precisely. It's about responsibility, not just accumulation. A profound connection, as you say.
So after graduating from Amherst at his father's urging, Coolidge moves to Northampton, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Pursues law.
Right. He didn't go to law school, though, which was common then. He apprenticed with a local firm, Hammond and Field. He read law, passed the bar.
Admitted in 97.
Yep. Admitted to the Massachusetts bar in 1897. By 1898, he opened his own law office.
What kind of law did he practice?
Mostly commercial law. He built a reputation as a, well, diligent attorney for local banks and businesses. And interestingly, he had a belief in staying out of court whenever possible.
Huh. Already showing that quiet, practical approach.
Very characteristic, yes. Much like his personal demeanor. And his personal life also took a significant turn during this period.
Right. He met his wife, Grace Goodhue.
Yes. In 1903, she was a University of Vermont graduate and a teacher at the Clark School for the Deaf in Northampton. A very different personality, apparently quite vivacious.
Opposites attract, maybe?
Perhaps. They married on October 4th, 1905, in a small ceremony. Apparently, Grace's mother initially objected to the marriage.
Why?
Her impression of Coolidge was, well, stern and uncommunicative, but they overcame it.
And the honeymoon story is quite telling, isn't it?
It is. They went to Montreal, planned for 2 weeks, but Coolidge requested they cut it short after just 1 week.
Back to work.
Seems likely. Years later, he wrote of her, quite touchingly, "For almost a quarter of a century, she has borne with my infirmities, and I have rejoiced in her graces." It suggests this deep appreciation for her balancing spirit.
They went on to have two sons, John, born in 1906, and Calvin Jr., born in 1908.
Yes. but tragedy would strike their family quite devastatingly. In June 1924, while Coolidge was president.
Right, this was during his presidency.
Yes. Calvin Jr. died. He was just 16 years old, died from sepsis.
How did that happen? It was something seemingly small, wasn't it?
Tragically small. He developed a blister on his toe while playing tennis on the White House courts without wearing socks. The blister got infected, and the infection spread rapidly. Sepsis.
Oh, that's just heartbreaking, especially for a father and a president.
It's truly awful for any parent. But for a man as reserved as Coolidge, already known as Silent Cal, this personal tragedy seemed to cast an even deeper shadow.
Did it affect his presidency?
Well, a psychiatric biographer even suggested that Coolidge, quote, ceased to function as president in the same way after his son's death, displaying symptoms consistent with major depressive disorder.
Wow.
His elder son, John, confirmed it years later, saying it hurt Coolidge terribly. It's just a sobering reminder of the immense human cost often hidden beneath the surface of public office. How intensely personal grief can impact even the most public figures.
That profound personal grief, especially while holding the highest office, It must have been almost unimaginable. And it makes you wonder how that internal struggle maybe further solidified that public image of quiet stoicism.
It's very possible. Throughout his life, Coolidge was known for his frugality, too. Preferred renting homes rather than owning, even as president.
Really? Even in the White House years, they rented elsewhere? Or just before?
Well, before the presidency, certainly. They rented in Northampton. The family were active members of Northampton's Edwards Congregational Church, grounding him in tradition, personal discipline.
So all these experiences, the family lineage, the early losses, the philosophical grounding, the tragedy, this was the bedrock upon which his political career was built.
Absolutely. All key elements of the man. #2, the ascendancy in Massachusetts politics, 1898-1921.
Okay, so from these formative years, Coolidge begins his climb in Massachusetts politics, a journey that, you know, eventually leads him to the national stage. The Republican Party was dominant in New England then.
Oh, very much so. And Coolidge quickly became active. He campaigned for Republican presidential candidate William McKinley back in 1896, joined the Republican City Committee the following year.
So he started at the local level.
Very much a step-by-step approach. Pragmatic. In 1898, he was elected to the City Council of Northampton. It was a non-salaried position, but gave him valuable early political experience, you know, learning the ropes of local governance.
Right. Then city solicitor.
Yes. From 1899 to 1901. Gained legal experience, got a modest salary, $600, which you said is about $22,000 today.
Roughly, yeah.
He even briefly served as clerk of courts, but resigned because it restricted him from practicing law. Still committed to his legal career at that point.
And here's that little anecdote that gives us a glimpse of the Silent Cal persona even back then. His only defeat at the ballot box.
Right, the school board election in 1904.
Yeah, 1904. He ran for the Northampton school board and lost when someone told him his neighbors voted against him because he didn't have any children in the schools.
He just gotten married.
Right. Recently married, Coolidge reportedly replied, with that signature dry wit, might give me time.
Classic Coolidge. That subtle humor, it hints at the man we'd come to know.
So from local politics, he steadily moves up to the state level.
Correct. In 1906, elected to the Massachusetts House of Representatives, served two terms. And interestingly, he was known as a progressive Republican during this period.
Progressive. How so?
He supported measures like women's suffrage and the direct election of senators, even while generally voting with his party. So it shows a kind of nuanced approach to his conservative leanings early on, a willingness to embrace certain reforms.
He also forged some important political alliances, right? Which seems crucial for his rise, showed some strategic thinking.
Absolutely critical. One was with U.S. Senator Winthrop Murray Crane, who controlled the powerful Western faction of the Massachusetts Republican Party. Coolidge was from the west of the state.
Okay, geographical connection.
And another key alliance was with Guy Currier. Currier provided the social distinction, the wealth, the connections that Coolidge himself lacked initially. That proved very helpful throughout his career.
So after the State House, he goes back home.
Returns to Northampton, gets elected mayor, serves from 1910 to 1912.
Was he effective as mayor?
Seems so. Achieved some impressive results, increased teacher salaries, retired some city debt, even managed a slight tax decrease. And he was reelected with an increased margin, showing his local popularity and effectiveness as a, you know, pragmatic leader.
Then back to Boston to the state Senate.
Elected to the state Senate in 1911. And a significant early test of his leadership came pretty quickly. He chaired a committee to arbitrate the Bread and Roses strike.
Ah, yes. Lawrence, Massachusetts, 1912. Yeah. A big, contentious strike.
Very tense situation. American woolen company workers. But Coolidge successfully navigated it, leading to a settlement that largely met the workers' demands. An early indicator of his ability to handle complex labor disputes with that quiet, firm hand.
It's also important to note his party loyalty during this time, especially with the big Republican split.
Oh, yes, 1912. The Taft versus Roosevelt split. The Bull Moose Party.
Right. The party was tearing itself apart.
Deeply split between the progressive wing, backing Teddy Roosevelt, and the conservative wing, supporting Taft. Despite his own progressive leanings on some issues, Coolidge remained loyal to the official Republican Party.
And that paid off.
Well, he was reelected to the Senate with an increased margin, further solidifying his position, showed his commitment to party unity, which Republicans valued.
Then, January 1914, he gets a big promotion within the Senate.
Yes, with help from Senator Crane and also his pro-women suffrage stance, still quite progressive, then Coolidge was unanimously elected president of the state Senate, a powerful role.
And it was in this role that he delivered that famous speech, Have Faith in Massachusetts.
That's the one.
Now, this speech, it isn't just a catchy title, is it? It seems like a really foundational text for understanding Coolidge's whole approach. Restrained, principled.
Even as a progressive Republican, yes, it really lays out his governing philosophy.
What did he say?
He said, do the day's work, if it be to protect the rights of the weak, whoever objects, do it. But then also, don't expect to build up the weak by pulling down the strong. Don't hurry to legislate. Give administration a chance to catch up with legislation.
Protect the weak, but don't tear down the strong. And slow down on making laws.
Exactly. It was extremely well received, garnered him admirers across the state, significantly boosted his profile, really laid the groundwork for higher office.
So that speech was a crucial turning point, crystallizing his image and philosophy.
Absolutely. Bolstered by the success and encouraged by supporters like Frank Stearns, a Boston department store executive who became another key ally and lifelong friend, Coolidge ran for lieutenant governor.
Paired with Samuel McCall for governor.
Right. Coolidge's Western Massachusetts base helped balance the ticket geographically. They won the 1915 election, and Coolidge defeated his opponent by over 50,000 votes, a clear sign of his growing appeal statewide.
And as lieutenant governor from 1916 to 19, he wasn't just ceremonial.
No, he took on a significant administrative role. Deputy governor, administrative inspector, chairman of finance and pardons committees. He even stopped practicing law during this time, showing full commitment to public service. Reelected twice alongside McCall.
Then McCall retires, and Coolidge makes his move for the top job.
Runs for governor in 1918, unopposed for the Republican nomination, his platform. Fiscal conservatism, vague opposition to prohibition, support for women's suffrage, and support for American involvement in World War I, which was ongoing then.
How did the election go?
He won the general election, but by a surprisingly narrow margin of just under 17,000 votes.
Close call.
But as governor, after WWI ended, he delivered, pushed for a $100 bonus for Massachusetts veterans, about $1,800 today.
Significant for veterans.
Yes. He also signed a bill reducing the work week for women and children from 54 to 48 hours, said something like, we must humanize the industry or the system will break down.
Interesting. Balancing progressive labor reform with fiscal conservatism.
Exactly. He also passed a budget keeping tax rates stable while trimming $4 million from expenditures, reducing state debt, delivered on those fiscal promises.
And he wasn't afraid to use the veto pen.
Not at all. Famously vetoed a 50% pay increase for legislators.
That must have been popular with voters, if not legislators.
Likely. And despite his personal opposition to prohibition, he held that privately he vetoed a bill in May 1920 that would have allowed selling low-alcohol beer and wine. Why? Constitutional supremacy.
Ah.
He declared, opinions and instructions do not outmatch the Constitution. Against it, they are void. Deep respect for the rule of law above personal preference or public sentiment.
But the event that really catapulted him onto the national stage was the Boston police strike of 1919.
Oh, absolutely pivotal. Boston police officers planned to unionize with the American Federation of Labor, the AFL. Police Commissioner Edwin U. Curtis strongly opposed this, suspended the union leaders.
And the police walked out.
About three quarters of the force went on strike. This led to sporadic violence, rioting in the city. A major public safety crisis unfolded.
What did Governor Coolidge do?
Initially, he deferred to local authorities, which was characteristic. But when the situation escalated, he acted swiftly, called up more units of the National Guard, restored Commissioner Curtis to office, and took personal control of the police force.
And Curtis fired the strikers.
All of them. Coolidge then called for a new, permanent police force to be recruited.
Then came the famous telegram exchange.
The defining moment. AFL leader Samuel Gompers telegraphed Coolidge, arguing the disorder was Curtis's fault for denying policemen's rights. Coolidge's public reply was electrifying. It just shot him into the national consciousness.
What did he say again? It's such a famous line.
There is no right to strike against the public safety by anyone, anywhere, anytime. And he added, I am equally determined to defend the sovereignty of Massachusetts and to maintain the authority and jurisdiction over her public officers where it has been placed by the Constitution and laws of her people.
Wow. So direct, so forceful, especially given the context.
Exactly. This was right in the middle of the first Red Scare. Intense anti-communist fear, paranoia about revolution sweeping the country after Russia.
So his stance resonated.
Powerfully. Coolidge's decisive action against the strike transformed him into a national hero for law and order. He lost some friends in organized labor, sure, but he emerged as a clear rising star among conservatives nationwide. And this really raises an important question, doesn't it? How much did this single, highly publicized event shape the public perception of Silent Cal as this firm, decisive leader? And how much did it propel him onto the national stage almost overnight?
That's a fantastic point. It makes you really consider the power of one defining moment.
Yeah.
How quickly did that image of the firm leader solidify after Boston?
Well, the electoral consequences were immediate and dramatic. His actions were widely publicized by supporters. And in the 1919 gubernatorial election,
his re-election did.
Right. He faced the same opponent as in 1918, but this time he won by an astounding 125,101 votes.
Whoa. Compared to less than 17,000 the year before.
More than seven times his previous margin. A landslide. And this victory immediately sparked suggestions that he should run for president in 1920. The stage was set.
Okay, let's follow that improbable path right to the White House. The 1920 Republican National Convention sounds like it was quite something.
Oh, it was. Most delegates were chosen by state party caucuses back then, which meant the field of presidential candidates was really fragmented. Lots of local favorites.
And Coolidge was one of those?
He was one, placed as high as sixth in early voting. But he wasn't really seen as a serious contender by the powerful party bosses who were mostly U.S. senators pulling the strings behind the scenes.
Who did the bosses want?
Well, after 10 ballots, with no clear frontrunner, the bosses and delegates finally settled on Senator Warren G. Harding of Ohio, a compromise candidate.
Okay, so Harding for president, that seems settled.
It seems like it.
And this is where things get really interesting, almost chaotic.
It's a fantastic story. After picking Harding, the party bosses also announced their choice for vice president, Senator Irvine Lenroot of Wisconsin. Then they just left.
They left, assuming the delegates would just rubber stamp their choice.
Apparently so. But a delegate from Oregon, Wallace McCament, who had read Coolidge's Have Faith in Massachusetts speech and was inspired.
This speech again.
Right. He spontaneously proposed Coolidge for vice president instead. And the suggestion, as the sources say, caught on quickly. The rank and file delegates were, quote, craving an act of independence from the absent bosses.
So the delegates revolted against the boss's pick.
Exactly. Led to Coolidge's totally unexpected nomination for vice president, completely reshaped the ticket, set him on this unforeseen path. It's a great example of, you know, grassroots momentum defying the establishment. A truly pivotal moment.
Absolutely remarkable. So with the ticket unexpectedly set, Harding and Coolidge, they faced the Democrats in 1920.
Right. James M. Cox and a young Franklin D. Roosevelt. Major issues were things like joining the League of Nations, the legacy of progressivism.
How did the campaign play out?
Harding ran his famous front porch campaign from home in Ohio. Very traditional. Let the voters come to him.
And Coolidge.
Coolidge hit the trail, traveled through the Upper South, New York, New England. But his audiences were carefully limited. Either people already familiar with him or those who appreciated his concise, short speeches.
Already leaning into the Silent Cal thing, even on the campaign trail. Brevity is a virtue.
Seems that way. It worked. On November 2, 1920, Harding and Coolidge won in a landslide.
How big?
Over 60% of the popular vote won every single state outside the South. And notably, they even won Tennessee, the first time a Republican ticket had won a Southern state since Reconstruction. A decisive mandate for a return to normalcy, as Harding called it.
So Coolidge becomes vice president. What was his role like? VP wasn't a very powerful office back then.
No, not many official duties. But Harding did invite him to attend cabinet meetings, which was actually a first, made him the first VP to do so, a precedent that continues today. He also gave a number of, well, unremarkable speeches around the country, mostly sticking to standard Republican positions. But it was really during this period that the legend of Silent Cal blossomed and became fixed in the public mind, often overshadowing what he was actually doing.
Right, the dinner party stories.
Exactly. He and his wife, Grace, who is much more outgoing, were invited to lots of Washington parties, and his quiet nature quickly became famous. Stories and jokes abounded, like him being silent in five languages.
And that famous bet.
The one where a dinner guest supposedly bet she could get more than two words out of him.
Yeah.
And he supposedly replied, "You lose." It's likely apocryphal Coolidge himself denied it later, but it certainly stuck.
Fit the image perfectly.
Perfectly. When asked why he went to so many parties if he was uncomfortable, he reportedly said, "Gotta eat somewhere."
Practical.
And Alice Roosevelt Longworth, Teddy's daughter, a famous wit, said that when Coolidge wished he were elsewhere, he looked then precisely as though he had been weaned on a pickle.
Ouch.
Yeah.
A vivid description. And even as president, he sort of leaned into this image.
He did. He once said, "The words of a president have an enormous weight and ought not to be used indiscriminately." He even told actress Ethel Barrymore, with that dry wit, "I think the American people want a solemn ass as a president, and I think I will go along with them."
He had a sense of humor about it then.
It would seem so. But this does raise that important question. Was Silent Cal a carefully constructed persona, a natural disposition, maybe even a coping mechanism after his son's death?
That's the core question, isn't it? Historians still debate it. Was it a shrewd political tactic in a noisy era?
Mm-hmm.
Or just who he was, maybe deepening after that terrible loss in 1924?
Right. Dorothy Parker's cynical remark when he died, "How can they tell?" really highlights how pervasive that quiet reputation was.
Yeah. His ability to both embody and maybe cultivate this image is quite unique. It makes you wonder about the real man beneath the silence.
It's truly a captivating part of his story. And then that sudden presidential ascension. August C, 1923. President Harding dies unexpectedly. Heart attack in San Francisco during a speaking tour.
And where was Vice President Coolidge?
Visiting his family home in Plymouth Notch, Vermont. A place so rural it lacked electricity and a telephone. Truly off the grid.
So how did he find out?
News arrived via messenger. Middle of the night, hand-delivered, Coolidge got the word, dressed, said a prayer, then came downstairs to greet reporters who had somehow already gathered outside the farmhouse.
Amazing how fast news traveled even then.
And then came that truly unique, almost theatrical moment in American history. His father, John Calvin Coolidge Sr., who happened to be a notary public and a justice of the peace.
Right, his father swore him in.
Administered the oath of office right there in the family parlor. By the flickering light of a kerosene lamp, 2.47 a.m., August 3, 1923.
Incredible scene. And then what?
After being sworn in as the 30th president, Coolidge simply returned to bed. The epitome of quiet dignity, even in that extraordinary moment.
Imagine the quiet drama, the profound dignity of that scene. It's such a powerful image, part of American lore now.
Absolutely. And there's a little footnote to that. The next day, back in Washington, Coolidge was secretly sworn in again.
Why?
By Justice Adolph A. Holing Jr. of the D.C. Supreme Court. It was purely precautionary. To prevent any potential legal questions about a state official administering a federal oath, this second oath-taking actually remained a secret for years, only revealed in 1932.
Wow. A remarkable, almost clandestine start to a presidency that would really shape the decade. So, stepping into the Oval Office after Harding's sudden death, the nation wasn't quite sure what to make of Coolidge. He'd kept a pretty low profile as VP. Many even expected him to be replaced on the 1924 ballot.
Right. And he immediately faced this huge challenge, restoring public confidence after all the Harding administration scandals, Teapot Dome being the most notorious, trust in government was really shaken.
How did he handle that? Did he clean house immediately?
He took a very methodical, principled approach, not impulsive. He believed those under suspicion were entitled to the presumption of innocence. He felt thorough Senate investigations would suffice rather than, you know, hasty condemnations.
So let the process play out.
Let the process play out. However, he did personally demand the resignation of Attorney General Harry Daugherty when Daugherty refused to cooperate with those investigations.
Okay, so he acted when necessary.
Yes. And then he meticulously arranged for a full briefing on all the wrongdoing from various experts to ensure no loose ends remained. This quiet, deliberate approach slowly began to rebuild trust, which was critical for the presidency at that time.
And then, December 6, 1923, he addresses Congress. What was significant about that speech?
Well, content-wise, he notably supported many of Harding's policies, formal budgeting, immigration restrictions, arbitration of coal strikes. But the truly significant thing was the delivery.
How so?
It was the very first presidential speech ever broadcast over the radio.
The first ever?
Wow.
A truly pioneering moment in presidential communication. It allowed him to connect directly with the American public in an entirely new way, bypass the newspapers to some extent.
That's huge. So his first year in office, 1924, sees some important legislative action.
Yes, several key acts reflecting his priorities. The Washington Naval Treaty, limiting naval arms, was proclaimed just a month into his term, generally well received.
Then the Veterans Bonus Bill.
Right. In May 1924, Congress passed the World War I Veterans Bonus Bill over Coolidge's veto, a rare but significant clash with Congress over spending, showing his fiscal conservatism early on.
And immigration.
Later that year, he signed the Immigration Act of 1924. It aimed to restrict Southern and Eastern European immigration, reflecting the era's frankly, nativist sentiments. Though Coolidge did append a signing statement expressing unhappiness with the specific exclusion of Japanese immigrants. A small pushback.
And taxes.
The Revenue Act of 1924 significantly reduced the top marginal tax rate from 58% down to 46%, cut personal income taxes across the board, but it also increased the estate tax and added a new gift tax. Kind of a mixed bag fiscally.
And perhaps most significantly for one group, the Indian Citizenship Act.
A landmark piece of legislation signed June 2, 1924. It granted U.S. citizenship to all Native Americans born in the United States. Now, about two-thirds already had citizenship through various means, marriage, military service, land allotments.
Right.
But this act completed the process for all remaining Native Americans living on reservations, extending full rights to a long marginalized group. A very important step.
So looking ahead to the 1924 election, Coolidge seeks the nomination in his own right.
Yes. And he gets it easily. Nominated on the first ballot at the Republican convention in Cleveland, solidified his grip on the party. Former Brigadier General Charles G. Dawes was nominated as his VP after Frank Loudon declined.
And the opposition.
Quite fractured. The Democrats nominated John W. Davis after a deadlocked convention, 103 ballots. Charles W. Bryan was his VP.
103 ballots. Wow.
Yeah. And critically, Robert M. La Follette, a progressive Republican senator, split from the GOP to form a new progressive party. This led many to believe a Democrat would win, just like in 1912 when Taft and Roosevelt split the Republican vote.
But then personal tragedy strikes Coolidge again right in the middle of this campaign.
Yes, just as things were ramping up, his younger son, Calvin Jr., dies in June 1924. That devastating infection from the blister.
How did that affect the campaign and Coolidge himself?
He became deeply withdrawn, outwardly even more subdued than usual. He later said, quite profoundly, that when he, the son, died, the power and glory of the presidency went with him.
Oh, heartbreaking.
His campaign became notably subdued, reflecting his grief and his naturally non-confrontational style. He delivered speeches on his theory of government, and several were broadcast over the radio again, pioneering that medium, allowing his quiet, measured voice to reach millions directly.
So despite the Republican split, despite his subdued campaign, how did the election turn out?
A resounding victory for Coolidge. He won every state outside the South except Wisconsin, which was La Follette's home state, secured 382 electoral votes, won the popular vote by 2.5 million. A powerful affirmation of his leadership and maybe a testament to the nation's desire for stability and prosperity under his quiet guidance.
Moving beyond the election, then, his presidency famously coincides with the Roaring Twenties, this period of, well, really rapid and expansive economic growth.
The Coolidge prosperity, as it was often called.
Right. And he became known for his hands-off governing approach, his staunch pro-business stance. Many credited these policies for the era's boom.
His philosophy on this was really summed up in that 1925 speech to newspaper editors, where he famously said, "After all, the chief business of the American people is business."
That's a quote everyone remembers.
They are profoundly concerned with buying, selling, investing, and prospering in the world. It perfectly captures his belief in the central role of commerce, private enterprise, prosperity as the natural outcome of unburdened economic activity.
Interestingly, though, he largely entrusted a lot of the administration's industrial policy to his Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover.
Who was very activist, wasn't he?
Very. Hoover energetically used government auspices to promote business efficiency, help develop new industries like airlines and radio. So while Coolidge kept his personal hands-off style, he allowed cabinet members like Hoover to be quite proactive, especially in fostering business growth.
That's a key distinction. However, Coolidge himself generally disdained direct federal regulation of business. He appointed men to the Federal Trade Commission, the Interstate Commerce Commission, who did little to restrict business activities.
So the regulatory state was pretty minimal.
One biographer described it as thin to the point of invisibility. But it's important to understand this in the context of the era's federalism. Historian Robert Sobel points out that Coolidge's seemingly contradictory stances supporting worker protections as governor, but not pushing for them as president, were likely due to the prevailing understanding of federal versus state responsibility. Things like wages, hours, child labor. Those were seen as state and local issues then, not federal ones.
So it wasn't necessarily a change in principle, but a difference in perceived federal jurisdiction.
Exactly. That was the common view in the 1920s.
One notable exception, though, to this non-regulation was the Radio Act of 1927.
Right. He signed that act, established the Federal Radio Commission, imposed the equal time rule for broadcasters, restricted licenses to stations serving the public interest, convenience, or necessity.
Why regulate radio but not other industries?
Well, radio was burgeoning, chaotic. Someone needed to assign frequencies, bring order. It was seen as a necessary step for the public good. Managing a new, limited resource to the airwaves demonstrated a pragmatic acceptance of federal intervention where a clear need arose.
Okay, let's talk taxation and government spending. That was really a cornerstone of his economic policy, wasn't it? Working with Andrew Mellon.
Absolutely. Coolidge adopted the policies of his Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon. Mellon advocated scientific taxation.
Scientific taxation, meaning?
The idea that lowering tax rates could actually increase government receipts by stimulating economic activity rather than just reducing revenue. Get the economy humming and the government gets more, even at lower rates.
And Congress bought into this?
Largely, yes. Led to significant tax reductions during Coolidge's term.
Along with cutting spending.
Yes. In addition to the tax cuts, Coolidge proposed substantial reductions in federal expenditures and a strong commitment to retiring the federal debt. Republicans in Congress were very much on board.
So what were the key pieces of legislation?
We saw the Revenue Act of 1924, which cut rates and remarkably eliminated all income tax for about 2 million people.
Wow. Wiped off the rolls entirely.
Then further reductions in the Revenue Acts of 1926 and 1928, all while keeping spending down to reduce the overall federal debt. By 1927, it's quite striking, only the wealthiest 2% of taxpayers were still paying federal income tax, a huge shift in the burden.
What were the results of these policies? Did spending stay flat? Did the debt go down?
Federal spending remained remarkably flat during his administration, yes. Allowed 1/4 of the entire federal debt to be retired.
A quarter of the debt. That's significant.
Very. And here's an interesting data point that fuels a lot of the historical debate. By 1929, after his tax cuts had brought the top rate down to 24%, for those making over $100,000.
Which is quite low compared to before.
Very low. The federal government collected over $1 billion in income taxes. And of that, 65% came from those top earners making over $100,000.
Wait, so lower rates on the rich brought in more money from the rich?
That's what the data suggests for that period. Contrast that with 1921. A 73% top tax rate yielded just over $700 million, with only 30% coming from those wealthiest earners.
That's a huge shift. Suggests Mellon's scientific taxation actually worked, at least in the short term.
It certainly had a measurable impact. And while federal spending was tightly controlled, state and local governments actually saw considerable growth in spending during this period, surpassed the federal budget by 1927, again, highlighting that federalist division of responsibilities.
So connecting this to the bigger picture, Coolidge's economic policy was essentially an early experiment in supply-side economics.
Decades before the term existed, yes. A bold experiment. The data clearly shows it boosted revenue from the wealthy in the short term, but its long-term impact and its potential contribution to the Great Depression that followed. That remains a central point of historical debate. A critical case study, even today, on tax policy and economic stability.
Okay, shifting to some of the more contentious issues he faced. Maybe none more debated than federal relief for farmers. They were really struggling then.
They were. Agriculture hadn't shared equally in the Roaring Twenties prosperity. Some in Congress proposed the McNary-Haugen Bill.
What would that have done?
It would have allowed the federal government to buy surplus crops, wheat, corn, and sell them abroad at lower prices. Effectively, a government price support, a subsidy.
And Coolidge's position?
Strongly opposed. Argued that agriculture must stand on an independent business basis. Said government control cannot be divorced from political control. He favored Secretary Hoover's ideas for modernizing agriculture efficiency, cooperatives over direct price manipulation, believed in market solutions.
Did the bill pass Congress?
Twice. In 1927 and 1928, the farm bloc was powerful.
Coolidge
vetoed it both times, famously. In his veto messages, he argued the bill wouldn't really help farmers, would mainly benefit exporters, and would expand the federal bureaucracy, all things he opposed on principle.
And he had that rather stark quote about farmers.
Yes, the rather blunt remark. Farmers never have made much money. I do not believe we can do much about it. Highlights his staunch commitment to limited government, even facing hardship in a key sector. A belief in individual responsibility, perhaps to a fault in this case.
Another contentious issue.
Huh.
The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927.
A massive disaster. The worst natural disaster on the Gulf Coast until Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And Coolidge faced considerable criticism for his response or perceived lack thereof.
What does he do or not do?
Well, he eventually named Herbert Hoover, who was sort of his go-to guy for big problems, to a commission for flood relief. But overall, scholars argue Coolidge showed a lack of interest in extensive federal flood control measures.
Why the reluctance?
It really underscores that fundamental tension of the era. Limited federal intervention versus growing public expectation for federal action in crises. Coolidge believed a presidential visit to the flood zone would be mere political grandstanding.
Optics weren't his priority.
No. And he felt incurring significant federal spending for flood control was undesirable. Believed property owners should bear much of the cost, as had been the tradition.
So when Congress did pass a compromise flood control measure in 1928,
Coolidge, true to form, declined to take credit. Sign a bill in private. A clear illustration of his consistent adherence to his principles, even at the cost of public relations or perceived compassion.
Okay, let's turn to civil rights and tolerance. How did Coolidge handle these issues? One biographer called him devoid of racial prejudice.
Yes, but he rarely took a leading role on civil rights, often prioritizing states' rights and local control, which often meant inaction on racial injustice. For example, Coolidge personally disliked the Ku Klux Klan,
which was powerful in the 1920s.
Very powerful. And no Klansman is known to have received an appointment from him. But during the 1924 election, while his opponents attacked the Klan, Coolidge largely avoided the subject, perhaps not wanting to give them more attention or maybe political calculation.
How did that play out with African-American voters?
It was complex. Some black leaders did endorse his opponent, John Davis, due to Coolidge's silence. Yet estimates suggest over 90% of non-Indiana black voters actually voted for Coolidge. The situation in Indiana was unique, with Klan control of the state GOP pushing many black voters there toward the Democrats. A really tangled picture.
Were there any positive developments during his term on this front?
It's important to note some things did improve, whether directly due to him or broader shifts. Lynchings of African Americans decreased during his administration, and millions of people actually left the Ku Klux Klan during his tenure. Its peak influence waned.
Did he use his platform at all? Speak out?
He did, at times. In his first State of the Union, he declared that African Americans' rights were just as sacred as those of any other citizen, and that protecting those rights was a public and a private duty.
Strong words. Did he push for legislation?
He repeatedly called for federal laws to make lynching a federal crime. But Congress, particularly Southern Democrats, consistently blocked such legislation. Legislative gridlock was fierce on this issue.
But he did sign the Indian Citizenship Act.
Yes. As we mentioned, June 10, 1924, granting citizenship to all Native Americans living on reservations. A very significant positive step.
Any other notable public statements?
Yes. On June 6, 1924, he gave a commencement address at historically black Howard University. He publicly thanked and commended African Americans for their rapid advances in education, contributions to society, and eagerness to serve in WWI, all while facing discrimination.
That must have been meaningful.
And later, in October 1924, during the election campaign, he gave a speech stressing tolerance of differences as an American value. thanked immigrants for their contributions, noted diversity caused conflict in Europe but was harmonious for the U.S., perhaps optimistically, urged immigrants to reject race hatreds and prejudices. These public statements, even without sweeping legislation, offered an important moral stance from the presidency.
Okay, turning to foreign policy, you mentioned he wasn't particularly interested in world affairs.
Not his primary focus, no. Largely centered on U.S. business, trade, and maintaining the status quo at home. He held a strong non-interventionist foreign policy viewpoint, supported American exceptionalism. He saw the 1920 election as a clear rejection of Wilson's idea of joining the League of Nations. Believed the League just didn't serve U.S. interests.
But his administration did engage internationally, right?
Yeah.
Just maybe cautiously.
Cautiously and with a focus on American interests, yes. He spoke in favor of joining the World Court, the Permanent Court of International Justice.
But with conditions.
Yes, provided the U.S. wouldn't be bound by advisory decisions, showing that characteristic caution. The Senate approved joining with reservations in 1926, but the U.S. ultimately didn't join after the League suggested modifications the Senate failed to act on. So close, but no cigar.
What about the Dawes Plan? That seems like a significant intervention.
It was, but primarily an economic one. 1924. The Coolidge administration nominated Charles Dawes to head a multinational committee. They produced this plan setting fixed annual amounts for Germany's WWI reparations payments and authorized a large loan, mostly from U.S. banks, to help stabilize the German economy. Good for Germany, good for U.S. banks getting repaid by allies.
And he tried to continue naval arms control.
Yes. Building on Harding's successful Washington Naval Conference, Coolidge sponsored the Geneva Naval Conference in 1927 to further curb naval strength. But this effort failed. Why? French and Italian boycotts? Disagreements between Britain and the U.S. over cruiser tonnages? It actually led, regrettably, to increased American naval spending afterwards.
But one lasting peace effort, maybe more symbolic, was the Kellogg-Briand Pact.
Yes, 1928. Named for his Secretary of State, Frank B. Kellogg. This treaty committed signatories, U.S., U.K., France, Italy, Germany, Japan, many others, to renounce war as an instrument of national policy.
Did it work? Obviously not entirely.
Well, it didn't ultimately outlaw war or prevent WWII, but it did provide a foundational principle for international law and diplomacy after WWII, shifted the moral landscape around aggressive war, making it illegitimate in principle.
What about regional policies? The Soviet Union, Mexico.
Continued Harding's policy of withholding recognition of the Soviet Union's standard anti-communist stance then. He normalized ties with post-revolution Mexico, recognizing new governments, supporting the elected government against the Cristero rebellion, lifting the arms embargo. Appointed Dwight Morrow as ambassador, who did a good job avoiding further conflict.
In Central America. The Caribbean. Still interventionist there.
Mixed bag. Ended the U.S. occupation of the Dominican Republic in 1924. Ordered withdrawal of Marines from Nicaragua in 1925, but then had to redeploy them in 1927 after political instability flared up again. Sent Henry Stimson to mediate a peace deal, but that actually extended the U.S. military presence beyond his presidency. Showed the complexities of that region.
And he went to Cuba.
Yes, January 1928. Led the U.S. delegation to the 6th International Conference of American States in Havana, his only international trip as president. Made him the last sitting U.S. president to visit Cuba until Barack Obama in 2016.
Wow, quite a gap. And Canada.
Authorized the St. Lawrence Seaway Project, a massive system of locks and canals allowing large vessels passage between the Atlantic and the Great Lakes. Huge for infrastructure and trade. So while often quiet, his foreign policy showed pragmatic engagement where U.S. economic or security interests were clearly involved.
Okay, let's talk about his team, his cabinet, his judicial appointments. Did he keep Harding's people?
Initially, yes, all of them. He believed that as successor to a president who died in office, he was obligated to keep Harding's counselors until the next election cycle, a move for continuity, stability after the scandals.
Who are the key players in his cabinet?
Andrew Mellon, Treasury Secretary, was arguably the most powerful, controlled financial policy. Some considered him more influential than Coolidge himself.
Really?
Well, on economic matters, certainly very influential. Herbert Hoover at Commerce was also prominent. Coolidge valued Hoover's ability to generate positive publicity for pro-business proposals and his energetic activist style in that specific area.
Secretary of State.
Charles Evans Hughes, until 1925, a heavyweight. Then Frank B. Kellogg of Kellogg Bryan Pact fame, Attorney General after Harry Daugherty resigned in disgrace in 24, was Harlan F. Stone, then John G. Sargent.
And Vice President. He didn't have it for his first term, right?
Correct. 1923 to 1925, no VP because Harding died, meant no direct successor in line initially. Charles G. Dawes served as VP during his second term, 1925 to 1929. And Dawes notably clashed with Coolidge sometimes, especially over farm policy, shows some internal tensions.
What about the courts? Supreme Court appointments.
Just one Supreme Court appointment. In 1925, he appointed Harlan F. Stone.
The same Stone who was Attorney General.
Yes. Fellow Amherst alumnus, Wall Street lawyer, conservative Republican, Coolidge brought him in as AG specifically to restore the Justice Department's reputation after Daugherty. Stone became a firm believer in judicial restraint on the court and was later appointed Chief Justice by FDR, interestingly.
In lower courts. Any milestones there?
He appointed 17 judges to the courts of appeals, 61 to district courts, and he made history by appointing Genevieve R. Klein to the United States Customs Court in 1928. She was the first woman ever named to the federal judiciary.
That's a significant first.
A progressive step for the time. He also signed the Judiciary Act of 1925, which gave the Supreme Court more discretion over its caseload, helping its efficiency.
So after all these eventful years, the scandals, the economy, the personal tragedy, he decides not to run again in 1928. Even though he was popular.
Highly popular, yes. Mm-hmm. But in the summer of 1927, while vacationing in the Black Hills of South Dakota, he made that choice, issued that famously terse statement to reporters.
The classic Coolidge statement.
Just 10 words. I do not choose to run for president in 1928.
Just like that. Did he explain further?
After letting reporters absorb it, he elaborated a bit. If I take another term, I will be in the White House till 1933. 10 years in Washington is longer than any other man has had it. Too long.
10 years is a long time in that office.
This decision, coming during prosperity and high popularity, really reveals a deeply personal understanding of the burdens of office.
What did he say in his memoirs about it?
He explained further, noting, "The presidential office takes a heavy toll of those who occupy it and those who are dear to them. While we should not refuse to spend and be spent in the service of our country, it is hazardous to attempt what we feel is beyond our strength to accomplish."
Wow. Speaks to his quiet character, that self-awareness. Maybe the shadow of his son's death still lingering too? A sense of limits?
Very possibly. A clear understanding of the personal cost. Hashtag tag hashtag V. Post-presidency and death. 1929-1933.
So after leaving office in 1929, Calvin and Grace Coolidge head back to Northampton, Massachusetts, to their home, the Beaches. But retirement for Coolidge, the man who believed in diligent work, wasn't exactly feet up on the porch.
No, far from it. He kept active, had a hacker runabout boat on the Connecticut River, apparently enjoyed boating.
Nice image.
He chaired the Nonpartisan Railroad Commission surveying the country's transportation needs, served as honorary president of the American Foundation for the Blind. He was a director of New York Life Insurance Company, president of the American Antiquarian Society, a trustee of Amherst College.
Kept busy applying those administrative skills.
Definitely. Applying them to various civic and corporate roles.
And he even took up writing.
He did. Published his autobiography in 1929, gave his own perspective on his life and presidency, and from 1930 to 1931, he wrote a syndicated newspaper column, Calvin Coolidge Says.
Sharing his thoughts with the nation again.
A quiet commentary on the unfolding events of the time, yes.
But the peace of his retirement was pretty quickly overshadowed by the Great Depression, wasn't it? Started just months after he left office.
Exactly. And with Herbert Hoover facing almost certain defeat in the 1932 election, some Republicans actually considered rejecting Hoover and trying to draft Coolidge to run again.
Draft Coolidge? Did they think his popularity could save them?
That was the hope, I suppose, that his image of prosperity and stability could somehow stem the economic tide.
Was Coolidge interested?
Not in the slightest. The former president made it crystal clear he was not interested, said he would publicly repudiate any draft efforts.
Even though he apparently wasn't Hoover's biggest fan privately?
Right. Despite privately remarking about Hoover, for 6 years, that man has given me unsolicited advice, all of it bad. Ouch.
Huh. But he still supported Hoover publicly.
He did. Made several radio addresses supporting Hoover's re-election bid. Showed his party loyalty, commitment to the ticket, even with his reservations. Hoover, of course, lost to Franklin D. Roosevelt in a landslide.
And sadly, Coolidge didn't live much longer after that.
No, he died quite suddenly. Coronary thrombosis, a heart attack at the Beaches. January 5th, 1933, he was only 60 years old.
Just a few short years after leaving office.
And shortly before his death, in a really poignant reflection of his personality, he told an old friend, "I feel I no longer fit in with these times."
Wow. The sense of being out of step with the new era of the Depression and the New Deal dawning.
It seems that way. He's buried in Plymouth Notch Cemetery, back in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, where his family home is maintained today as a historic site. A quiet resting place for Silent Cal.
So what does history truly make of this silent president of the Roaring Twenties? It's complex, right? Despite being incredibly popular while in office.
Hugely popular.
His historical reputation is generally rated below average by modern historians. That's quite a shift.
It is. Scholar David Greenberg notes that the Great Depression, starting so soon after Coolidge left office, seriously eroded his reputation. Fairly or unfairly, the crash cast a long shadow back on the preceding prosperity.
What are the main criticisms historians level against him?
Often criticized for a perceived lack of assertiveness, sometimes called a do-nothing president. The argument being he only enjoyed high approval because times were good and he didn't tackle underlying problems. Some also scrutinize him for signing laws that broaden federal regulatory authority, like the Radio Act, arguing it inadvertently paved the way for more federal expansion later, ironically contrary to his own philosophy.
And the surveys, the rankings reflect this critical view.
Often, yes. A 1982 Chicago Tribune survey of 49 historians ranked him eighth worst U.S. president.
Eighth worst. That's harsh.
Yeah. In 2006, British journalist William Shawcross called him the worst president of the 20th century, though a more recent 2021 C-SPAN survey was a bit more nuanced.
How so?
It gave him higher marks for moral authority and administrative skills, acknowledging his integrity and competence. But it still ranked him only 24th out of 44 presidents overall, with poor ratings for setting an agenda and pursuing equal justice, reflecting those criticisms about his passive approach to some big issues.
Yet despite these often critical historical rankings, Coolidge's hands-off government approach, his fiscal conservatism, it continues to resonate strongly with modern conservatives, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. His principles are frequently invoked in discussions about limited government, fiscal responsibility, the idea that too much government stifles prosperity. He's become something of an icon for that wing of political thought.
It's really interesting how historical figures like Coolidge get reinterpreted, championed by different ideologies across generations. Ronald Reagan was a big admirer, wasn't he?
Huge admirer. In 1981, President Reagan publicly praised Coolidge's laissez-faire policy as a model. And in a very powerful symbolic gesture, Reagan actually replaced a portrait of Thomas Jefferson in the White House cabinet room with one of Coolidge.
Swapped Jefferson for Coolidge. That's a statement.
A very clear nod to his admiration and a statement about his own conservative philosophy. So Coolidge's principles, clearly, they continue to spark debate and inspire certain groups.
Now, one of the most surprising aspects of his legacy, something that really pushes back against the Silent Cal stereotype, is his role as a communication innovator.
Yes. This is often overlooked. Despite that reputation for being quiet, even reclusive, Coolidge was actually a pioneer in using new media. Made radio history several times as president, showed a really pragmatic understanding of the evolving public sphere.
How so? Beyond the radio speeches.
Well, first, he made himself incredibly available to reporters. Gave an astounding 520 press conferences during his presidency.
520, that's a lot.
More regularly than any president before or since. A real commitment to press access, which contrasts sharply with the silent image.
And the media firsts.
His second inauguration in 1925 was the first presidential inauguration ever broadcast on radio. His December 1923 speech to Congress was the first presidential radio address, as we noted, bringing his voice directly into American homes.
And film.
Yes. August 1924, he became the first president to appear in a sound film. President Coolidge, taken on the White House grounds, using the cutting-edge phonofilm sound-on-film process. Groundbreaking stuff.
You could actually hear the president speak on film for the first time.
Exactly. He also famously welcomed Charles Lindbergh back after his 1927 transatlantic flight, presented him with the Medal of Honor. That event was filmed and widely seen, reinforcing his image as a modern leader connected to moments of national pride.
And he even took legislative action to regulate radio with the Radio Act of 1927.
Right, establishing the Federal Radio Commission. Right. So this whole aspect of his legacy truly challenges that simple Silent Cal stereotype. It reveals a pragmatic leader who understood and leveraged the power of emerging communication technologies to connect with the public, just in his own quiet but effective way.
A testament to his adaptability, his foresight, proves he was anything but just a relic of the past, even if he felt out of step by the very end. Hashtag tag tag outro.
So we've journeyed through the pretty remarkable life of Calvin Coolidge. From those humble Vermont beginnings, those profound intellectual influences, his unexpected rise through Massachusetts politics, capped by that decisive handling of the Boston police strike, we've seen him navigate profound personal tragedy, restore confidence to the White House after scandal, preside over the Roaring Twenties with that distinctive hands-off economic philosophy.
And surprisingly make pioneering use of new media like radio and sound film.
Exactly. His story is really one of principled conservatism, quiet determination, and maybe surprisingly an ability to capture the public imagination in his own unique way. You now have hopefully a much deeper understanding of the man behind Silent Cal, the context of that Coolidge prosperity, and the debates, the very lively debates that continue to surround his legacy today. You've heard his own words on ethics, on governance, even on the chief business of America.
He was definitely a man of paradoxes, a reserved leader in a truly vibrant, almost chaotic era, who left an indelible, if intensely debated, mark on American history.
Definitely debated.
And as we reflect on his tenure, that economic boom he oversaw, only to be followed so quickly by the Great Depression, we're left with a powerful question, aren't we? Was Coolidge's commitment to limited government and fiscal restraint a wise stewardship of prosperity that built reserves for a rainy day? Or did his do-nothing approach, as critics call it, miss critical opportunities to address underlying economic vulnerabilities before the crash?
It's the central question about his economic legacy.
And maybe more broadly, what might that tell us today about the delicate balance between government action and individual liberty, especially in times of rapid change? And that enduring debate over the proper role of government in a free society.
A question that certainly hasn't gone away. It resonates just as strongly now.
Something for all of you to think about. Thanks for diving deep with us.